first in Toronto, and in 1991.
Yeah.
And then held postdoc position at
Western
Ontario, and ultimately landed in Lethbridge. And he's going to come tell us something about the despatialization.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Looks like you followed the Turing machine right here.
Okay, am I reasonably audible? Good. Well, first of all, many thanks to Chris Fuchs and the Vernier Institute for inviting me here. Astonishingly warm hospitality towards a guy who's going to drop in one afternoon and give a quick talk and sort of welcome like a long lost son or something like that. So it's really been very, very nice. it seems to me the Perimeter Institute is founded on a very interesting principle of management, human resources management, which is that if you find talented people and give them what they need and treat them well, they might do good work. And this is an astonishingly novel management concept, and I'm really, really impressed with that. what I'm going to talk about today is the title may not make a lot of sense at first, but I'll explain what I'm talking about as I go along. Perhaps I should explain. Again, I'm coming to you as a philosopher. I've studied quite a bit of physics, but I'm still essentially a philosopher. And what I'm trying to do is, I'm afraid I don't have any pretty mathematical results for you today. And even if I had them, I probably wouldn't present them today because that's not what I'm after. What I'm trying to do is present a big picture. I'm painting a pretty broad brush. I'm going to slop a little bit of paint around when I do it. But I'm trying to kind of get a sort of a big picture here of a whole lot of subjects. And I've got a lot of things to cover here. May not get through them all, but might as well just plunge in. Okay, so just start with a picture of Lee Smolin's book here. And I was really hoping he'd be able to come this afternoon. This book was published a couple of years ago, The Trouble with Physics. Wonderful book, fascinating book. I think to some people, no doubt, an infuriating book. despite the cute pun, the visual pun on the cover, it's not just a critique of string theory. It's a broader critique of theoretical physics as a whole, really since World War II. And Smolin makes the fascinating and very challenging statement that why, despite so much effort by thousands of the most talented and well-trained scientists, has fundamental physics made so little definitive progress in the last 25 years? One would have to go back to the time of Lavoisier to find a 25-year period in which there have been fewer advances in fundamental understanding. Now, of course, he's not talking about applications. I mean, the proliferation of applications obviously has been huge in the last 20 or 30 years. But where's our new concepts? Have we made any breakthroughs on the great mysteries of quantum mechanics versus relativity and so forth? His view is no, not much. It's interesting that his book has elicited some rather, grumpy responses from string theorists, needless to say. But I maybe somebody can correct me. I haven't seen anybody who has actually seriously questioned his main claim here, which is that for the last 20 to 30 years, really since the early to mid 80s or something, kind of stuck. We're not going anywhere. Just trying a lot of different things and nothing's working. Now, in this talk, it's not my purpose to go into a deep review of all of the reasons why Smolin thinks this is the case. A lot of his discussion centers around the fact that, as he says, there are pathologies in the culture of theoretical physics since World War II that militate against conceptual innovation. And he has a long discussion of this. I can't do justice to that in this talk. I think Smolin and all of us would be very ready to agree that part of the reason that we haven't made that much progress is just because of the extreme difficulty of the intellectual problems we face right now. But Smolin makes the rather challenging claim that, no, there are these sort of social or cultural pathologies as well. he also insists that it's time to get back and be philosophers again. He says a philosophical analysis of time, space, causation, other fundamental physical categories is necessary. And Rovelli, Bill Unruh, and other people have made similar remarks to this effect. And they harken back to people like, well, Einstein himself and Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Bohr, who all had the philosophical training to some extent, took it quite seriously, and often had philosophical approaches to their work. Not, of course, they did good technical stuff too. Okay, so Smolin believes this is one of the things we're lacking, is nobody does philosophy anymore, except for those peculiar philosophers of physics. And then he also makes a more specific suggestion, which is, he says a lot of the problems he feels have to do with our misunderstandings of the nature of time, and he says we have to despatialize time. In so many ways of looking at things in physics right now, time is just a sort of another, a funny spatial dimension. We don't really know what it is. And really my main purpose in this talk is to explore what that means, what it might mean to say that we should despatialize time. Okay, but I just want to spend one or two minutes on what philosophy is and why philosophy might have anything to do with this sort of enterprise and sort of what I'm doing here today. Now, it is a philosophical question as to what philosophy is, and you would be very hard-pressed to find two professional philosophers who would actually agree on what it is they're supposed to be doing. Well, we have one other professional philosopher in the room here. He probably doesn't agree with the statement that I just made. But anyway, I think it'd be a lot easier finding two physicists who would be able to agree on what physics is, or maybe two medical doctors who agree on what medicine is. But philosophers don't know what philosophy is, and I'm not going to attempt to characterize it today in fullness. I just want to mention what I think are a couple of pertinent characteristics of philosophy, at least the way I do it and the way a lot of philosophers do it. First of all, a really central part of philosophy is to question all the basic assumptions and definitions, no matter how implicit or obvious they may seem to be. Everything's on the table in philosophy, everything. So in physics, you sometimes have this phenomenon of, well, there's some things which are, as Pauli put it, not even wrong. You should just know that, you know, that's not to be discussed. In philosophy, pretty well everything is or should be on the table. And sometimes our students find that quite upsetting, but that's what we do. Many philosophers, certainly I do, work in the tradition of our great, you know, spiritual inspiration, Socrates, who argued it was his duty to be what he called the gadfly of society. The gadfly, of course, is just an insect like a horsefly or something that buzzes around and keeps the cows. The cows want to just sort of complacently graze in the field, and the gadfly sort of pestures them into motion. So that's part of what we want to do is ask the awkward questions, the questions that people don't want to hear about. Why are you doing it that way? Another important cultural aspect of philosophy is that, by and large, unlike scientists, sometimes mistakes are allowed. I mean, most of what we teach is in our courses are the mistakes of bright people in the past. And we're allowed to be wrong as long as, and even encouraged to be wrong, so long as we do it in a way that's interesting, in a way that you can learn something. Sometimes today's culture of science, and Smolin explains this in great detail, sometimes today's culture of science tends to discourage intellectual risk-taking for a number of pretty obvious reasons. And we try and get away from that. So my hope today is to make some interesting mistakes. There isn't a chance that what I'm going to tell you is right, but at least I hope that it's wrong in an interesting way. So getting back to time, roughly speaking, in thinking about time going back through earliest years, there are very roughly speaking, two major sort of metaphysical views about the nature of time. One of statist's view, which says that, in a sense, passage or motion or change is unreal. And then there's a dynamicist view. Start with statist's views about time. Famous statement by Hermann Weyl, who said, the objective world just is. It does not happen. There's just this four-dimensional geometry. And the fact that we think it happens, that we think that things change and we see the past, but we don't see the future and so forth, is just sort of an illusion of perspective, of something funny to do with the four-dimensional structure of the human mind, or perhaps even a misinterpretation. Well, here's Kurt Gödel, who argued very strongly for the statist's view, basically said our persistent belief in the reality of change is simply due to a failure to understand space-time structure. So it's sort of like a person who very naively thinks that the Earth is flat and that he's at the center of it, just because if you stand out in the middle of a prairie, it sort of looks that way. But really, if you understand a bit about geography, you know it's not true. Gödel's view would look, if we just, people were better educated about space-time structure, and they wouldn't make this mistake of thinking that change is real. And comment by Julian Barber, stillness reigns. Right, had a recent argument to the effect that time is unreal. Okay, dynamicist views. I just borrowed the famous line from Galileo: "Effer si muove, but still it moves." Aristotle was a dynamicist. He mocked the statism of Parmenides. Parmenides was an ancient Greek philosopher who had a complicated argument that, to the effect that change is unreal. We didn't get into the details of his argument today. Melissus was a student of his. Aristotle thought their views were ridiculous, and Aristotle said nature is a principle of movement. That's what just nature is, things moving and changing all the time. Aristotle also made, a very useful distinction between change or motion and time itself. And he said, look, time is merely a scale by which we keep track of changes in motions. And time is established essentially by comparing one motion to another, meaning how many heartbeats elapse during the course of a lecture or something like that. You need, essentially, time is just a number or measure of motion. And what's ontologically interesting is not time. Time is just a coordinate established by a measurement procedure. It's motion or change. More recently, David Bohm, who's one of the few distinguished physicists of modern times, who's taken a very openly dynamicist view, Bohm said in the mid-70s in an interview, there is an unknown reality which can only be characterized as eternal flux or flow. Sounds very mysterious. And again, very similar to Aristotle. I assume Bohm had read as Aristotle, but Bohm said, movement is fundamental and time is an order which we derive. Movement is the fact with which we begin. Now, Bohm also said, and I've described this as a downside, and I'll explain why. If all of this is right, reality cannot be specified unambiguously. Therefore, accepting the reality of motion or change could force us to accept limitations on rational describability, similar to those following from the works, for example, of Heisenberg and Gödel. And this is why a lot of people don't always articulate this concern perfectly, but why a lot of people are very uncomfortable with the kind of dynamicist view, because it seems to be sort of mushy and mystical and kind of anti-rational. It says, well, you know, there's always going to be something you can't describe going on. And I see Plato himself didn't like, was very uncomfortable with what he called the world of becoming, because he said, nothing in the world of becoming ever just is what you think it is. You can never pin it down, damn it. It's always slithering and becoming something else. As soon as you think you understand something, it has become something else. And so there's a kind of incompleteness of understanding of the world that's implicit in this dynamicist view, which, some people are very uncomfortable with that. I'm going to suggest maybe the best we can do in order to defend the reality of time is to show the notion that it's all there is in conflict with physics. But the larger issue is maybe we just have to live with that. Maybe it just is a fact of life that there are limitations on completeness of describability. I'll come back to that. Now, I just put in a slide here. Just, I think it's fair to lay my cards on the table. My own prejudices, and these are things that I can't prove. These are just kind of my hunches that I work from, and I'm prepared to be shown that I'm wrong on these. But my first basic sort of thing that I come from is the world is quantum all the way down. Right? You know the old joke about it's turtles all the way down from Hawking's book, right? Well, I think it's quantum all the way down. Oh, that goes back to William James, but there's a big part. Hawking stole it. Well, there's a story, you know, in Hawking's beginning where somebody is presenting the Big Bang Theory and this little old lady comes up at the end and says, look, you know, the truth is the world is a gigantic flat thing sitting on the back of a turtle. And then the guy demurs and the lady says, Well, you're a very clever young man, but it's turtles all the way down, right? So I'm saying it's quantum all the way down. Even, sure.
Do you believe in something like Everett's quantum theory?
No, I don't buy the many worlds theory. No, because what I should put here is to say it's quantum all the way down, but I don't know what that means yet. But no, I'm not a many worlds guy. I've got to be careful here. Abner Shimoni once said that discussions of many worlds theory tend to take up all the time a lot of
it. Yeah, so that's
I'm very happy to do that if we want. Yes.
I simply saying that you're not excluding that some deeper theory would show up.
Oh, absolutely not. But what I'm saying, what I am saying is that we're not going to go back to a classical or semi-classical picture. That's really what I'm saying. But I'm certainly allowing for the possibility that there's, as I said, we don't really know what quantum mechanics is. But so this is a bit sort of hyperbole to some extent. But and to some extent, what I'm saying here will become a little clearer as I go along. I think, and again, I can't fully prove this, I think that this implies the ontological indeterminacy of regions of space-time, likely including that region we style the future. And that's mostly what I'm going to argue for today, although, again, in this very broad brush kind of way. I think the quantum indeterminacy is in part a reflection of inherent dynamism in the physical world, and thus, in contrast to Barber, I believe that movement reigns. As I say, these are essentially prejudices or starting points, and I'm prepared to be proven wrong. Okay, so does a quantum indeterminacy imply openness? Well, I'll just start with a couple of quotes from famous authors here to show that for many people who know a bit about quantum mechanics and relativity theory, they've taken it as just utterly obvious that it does. And here's a quote from Paul Teller's book, An Interpretive Introduction to Quantum Field Theory from the mid-90s. And Teller said, on a pre-quantum conception, a particle always has an exact space-time trajectory, as I am sure all readers know. Conventional quantum mechanics already gives up on exact trajectories. The uncertainty relations for position momentum require these never to receive simultaneous exact values in quantum descriptions of particles. Right? And that's in a book on local quantum field theory. Right? And here's a very interesting passage from Wheeler-Meister and Form, you know, the giant book that bends space-time all by itself, right? And back in 73, they said, the uncertainty principle deprives one of any way whatsoever to predict the deterministic classical history of space evolving in time. No prediction of space-time, therefore no meaning for space-time, is the verdict of the quantum principle. That object, which is central to all classical general relativity, four-dimensional space-time continuum geometry, simply does not exist except in a classical approximation. Now, you can sort of hear Wheeler's voice coming through there, but you know, to people who knew a lot about the subject, this is sort of so self-evident that they think it doesn't need explanation. I'm not saying they're right, but I'm just trying to represent their viewpoint here. This is not a new idea. I did a bit of historical work on quantum mechanics last year or two, and discovered that there's a very nice paper by Mara Beller, where she traces this all the way back in 1924, which is before Heisenberg formulated the first version of quantum mechanics, before the uncertainty relations in 1927. Born argued that because of quantum discontinuities, space-time lost all meaning as an independent background for atomic processes. Now, he didn't know how to make that work as a theory. He just thought that's where this has got to lead. And this is, again, before even the first versions of matrix mechanics came out, which was a couple of years after that. However, by the late 1920s, and it's interesting how quickly the ground shifts in this literature, most physicists, including Heisenberg himself, had gone back to a more conservative picture with a classical Minkowski background to quantum physics and time in particular just as a sort of quasi-classical parameter. A C number is the relaxed terms. And there are various reasons for that. But essentially, it was sort of a feeling that they'd gone a bridge too far and they had to step back a little bit. They just, yeah, maybe Born was right, we just don't know how to make that work. So they went back to something, you know, there's an old saying that, by Medawar that science is the art of the possible. And my sense of this literature of this kind is that they just sort of thought, okay, let's go back to something at least we know is going to work. And so they try and circle the field for another landing and go forward again. Because certainly in those days, nobody had the slightest idea how you would quantize space-time. Although Heisenberg, in his first great paper on quantum mechanics, came close to it. Because he described position and time, position and momentum, just as sort of matrix components, and not fundamental parameters. Okay, so going on in history, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, there's this whole thing, quantum electrodynamics, quantum local quantum field theory, which was tremendously successful. And then this, of course, was the basis for the so-called standard model. And quantum field theory and quantum and particle theory use classical Minkowskian background and very explicitly. Various patches were put into quantum theory to, in a sense, protect relativity theory from quantum theory, such as microcausality, and many physicists are very reluctant to move away from that picture. Why? Well, because it works and it seems risky to go beyond it. And, so hence, despite the intuitions of people like Warren Wheeler, the closed future and block universe picture still lives because, in a sense, perhaps you could just say because we don't know how to do without it. Okay, where am I now? Now, the other thing that comes up here is the question of simultaneity. And this is something I've done a fair bit of thinking about, is different the problem of simultaneity and different possible conceptions of it. And again, I haven't got time today to go into everything you can say about this, but any attempt to sort of speak about an open versus open future, if you have any kind of notion in which there are, in a sense, different ontologies of past, present, and future, you have to address the so-called standard argument, or what I call it here, which is goes like this. Any way of partitioning the world into space, into past, present, and a possibly open future must be in terms of a simultaneity relation. Right? Now, the next premise in this argument, and this argument has been stated by probably dozens of authors in slightly different ways, but sort of comes to the same thing. The next premise is the only physically significant kind of simultaneity is in terms of the time coordinate. And I've emphasized this premise because it's usually unstated in most versions of this argument that you'll see in the literature. Usually people don't bother to state this explicitly because they think it's just too obvious to mention. And my view is that it's one of those things that needs a little closer examination. So, and you know how it goes, everybody here knows how this goes. The time coordinate is frame dependent, as Einstein showed us back in 1905. Therefore, judgments of simultaneity in terms of time coordinate are frame dependent and do not pick out sets of events in an invariant or objective way. Okay. Only invariant structures, such as those that link the same sets of events, which would be those that link the same sets of events regardless of their description in different frames of reference, can mark an objective or ontological distinction, such as that between past and future. Therefore, there is no way in a relativistic universe to mark an ontological distinction between past, present, and future. They're all equally real or equally unreal. So this is the standard argument. Again, many philosophers, many physicists, many popular science writers have stated some version of this, slightly different words, but sort of comes to this. I'll put that on the back burner. We'll come back to that at the end of the talk. I wanted to introduce some other considerations first, and we have to come back and look at this so-called standard argument again. Okay. So, to carry out the project that I'm sort of investigating here, I think there are three requisites, essentially. It's a three-part process. We need a precise mathematical characterization of the notion of a closed future, and I'm going to give you some hints in that direction today. I haven't got an exact theory. We need a way of testing whether such a future is tenable in a quantum universe. And if it turns out that it is not, then we need a response to the standard argument. So that's kind of the large project. And then the general idea is to see if one can construct a quantum no-go theorem against the closed future. That's roughly the kind of thing I'm trying to do here. I'm going to spend some time explaining what that might mean. So a little bit of history here, and again, well known to many people here, but I just find it fascinating. It's worth reviewing this. This call is from EPR to Bell. Even before 1910, Einstein realized that there was something funny about the statistics of light quanta. They were too well correlated for their own good, you might say. Einstein was, of course, a master statistician. He one of the major developers of quantum theory. And I think, historically, he was the first or one of the first to realize that there was this entanglement or non-well, he didn't even have a word for it at that point. This funny stuff was going on. I think he was ahead of almost everybody in realizing that. He later came to call it the spooky action at a distance, in German, the Spukhafte Fernbeziehung. He regarded quantum spooky action at a distance as absurd, literally a threat to scientific rationality. He wished it would go away. But it would, and actually, interesting historical side, like that's only come out fairly recently. In 1927, I think, or maybe early 28, Einstein himself wrote a very long and detailed paper in which he created a causal version of wave mechanics. So just a few months after Schrodinger, Matlung De Broglie played around a little bit with this. Einstein did them one better, produced a very detailed, very, very thoroughly worked out wave mechanical theory of a causal version of quantum mechanics, hoping to get rid of the spooky action at a distance, or what we now call entanglement. Hoping to get rid of entanglement. He couldn't get rid of it, because of course you can't. And so he didn't publish the paper. Now, I don't know if it's been republished, if it's been printed yet, but he actually sat on this. It would have been one of his, actually perhaps a significant contribution to physics, but he just couldn't make the spooky action at a distance go away. So he thought he had to be wrong, so he just filed it after he wrote this paper. So. And then, of course, in 1935, you have the EPR paper, which is a very, very subtle and difficult paper. I think in that, Jim, in that seminar we did years ago, we spent two full periods going through the EPR paper, line by line, equation by equation. There's a lot going on there. But in very simple terms, what the EPR authors are saying is that the apparent action of the distance of quantum mechanics was due to the incompleteness of the theory. There had to be a fully local story explaining why particles are correlated the way that quantum mechanics successfully predicts. So, I mean, just to give a rough analogy, if somebody saw, if you saw two siblings, brothers and sisters, you'd notice there'd be various facial resemblances between them. You might think, well, how is that possible? But of course, if you knew something about heredity, you realize, well, these two people look similar because they had the same parents. And really, there's no spooky action and distance going on between them. It's just that there's a common ancestry, there's a common cause for their similar appearance, right? So that's what Einstein wanted. Sometimes called hidden variables, you know, which is a bit of a misnomer, but we'll just go with that. In the 1930s, von Neumann argued that the hidden variable underpinnings of quantum statistics are mathematically impossible. Turned out he was wrong, but in a funny way. Bohm in 1952 proves von Neumann wrong, but Bohm's theory depends on non-local dynamics via something called the quantum potential. So it seems as if you can, in a sense, maybe get some kind of quasi-classical or quasi-deterministic underpinning of quantum mechanics, but you have to allow for non-locality in a very severe way. And as I was saying to Chris earlier, that's probably part of why Bohm lost his job at Princeton. Well, of course, he got into some political trouble too, but that didn't help. Okay. Well, actually, I remember some years ago, I took a history of quantum mechanics seminar with Jed Buchwald, who was at Toronto at the time. And Jed had actually studied physics at Princeton in the 1960s. And he said that at Princeton in the 1960s, he said, you did not mention the name Bohm. It was a career ender to mention Bohm's name. If you were a student or something like that. Bohm did, it was a non-person, right? It was just so embarrassing. So anyway. So in 1964, Bell, who was not afraid to think about Bohm, wondered if any so-called completion of quantum mechanics had necessarily to do with non-local. And so what a lot of people, Shimonis describe what Bell did as so-called experimental metaphysics. He found a way of taking this apparently sort of intangible metaphysical concern about non-locality and translating into something that could be measured and tested. So he So Bell studied spin correlations in a particular version of the EPR experiment that had actually first been described by Bohm, and showed that if such correlations are determined by local hidden variables, then they have to obey certain mathematical inequalities, so-called Bell inequalities. And then he did a fairly straightforward quantum mechanical calculation. Actually, he didn't bother doing the calculation because it's sort of second year quantum mechanics, and showed that, in fact, these inequalities are violated by quantum mechanics all over the map. But that was only theoretical. At that point, there weren't any, although in a sense it was implicit in the entire structure of quantum mechanics. At that point in the early 60s, there weren't experiments explicitly designed to check, to test that question. So it took about 15 years. And I heard an interesting talk given by Gordon Fleming from Penn State when I was at Western in the mid-90s. Fleming, who's a particle physicist and field theorist, who was very interested in foundational questions, and he worked through this period. And the term he used was schizophrenic. He said physicists in this period, from, say, Bell up to 1980, were schizophrenic in the following sense, that they were of two minds about the whole thing. On the one hand, they desperately wanted Bell to be wrong. They were very uncomfortable with non-locality. They wished it would, just as Einstein did, they wished it would go away. It's just an irksome thing. And yet at the same time, this is the other side of their thinking, they use quantum mechanics all the time in their work. They know perfectly well it's right, and they know that Bell was right and that quantum mechanics violated locality. And then finally, around 1980 or so, people like Alain Aspé and a whole bunch of other people come up with this sort of experiment after experiment eventually that really, at a certain point, you just had to say, okay, Bell was right. Meanwhile, mathematical work by Gleason, 1957, Cochin and Specker, 1967, showed that more formally, that predictions of quantum mechanics are, in general, inconsistent with Boolean underpinnings of quantum statistics. And I'm going to explain what that means in a minute. And then actually, Bell's theorem, many people such as Jeff Boob and Dave Merman have argued that Bell's theorem is simply a special case of a generalized, what's often called Bell-Cochin-Specker theorem, for space-like separate entangled particles. So Bell's theorem is what you get when the quantum system is extended over space. Okay, so let's talk a bit about what is Boolean energy. What does this mean? Now, I'm not going to give a very formal mathematical definition of this. We don't need to, but the sense, what we need here is the sense of it, and you can be describing it in several sort of equivalent ways. One way to put it, to say that something has a Boolean property structure is to say that its properties obey set theory. One way of thinking about it. Equivalently, every possible proposition about the properties of that thing has a definite truth value, even if one might not know them for practical reasons. So it's the question of how much change do I have in my pocket at the moment. Well, I don't know either. I probably have a couple of bucks worth of change in my pocket. But the question is, does Kent have $1.37 worth of change in his pocket right now? Yes or no? Does have a yes or no answer, even if I don't know what it is. Another way of describing Booleanity, there is a logically consistent description of the whole of the thing. Sort of in one bundle of propositions. And I'm not saying at the same time, I'm saying in one bundle of propositions. So kind of, I feel like, logical simultaneity going on here. Every possible experimental question we can ask about this thing already has an answer before we ask it. Just like the question about how much change do I have in my pocket right now. And then another way of describing it was very interestingly worked out by Inmar Kotovsky. Yes, was there a question?
Yeah, when you said logic, I mean, I'm asking this, I won't give you the background to the question, but later. Maybe. Okay. When you said there's a logically consistent description, does that mean according to the rules of classical logic?
Yeah, right, because this is Boolean. Yeah, it means. It means there's. It simply means you can write a long string of propositions, conjoin them all together, and it's not contradictory.
So I actually think that the way out is to widen that requirement.
Well, of course, that's what a lot of people have done with different versions of quantum logic.
No, it's not the same. Well, yeah. It's apparently not the same as quantum logic.
Okay, well, maybe we should talk about that.
It has to change the Boolean structure.
I'm not sure exactly which thing you're talking about, but I'm sure there's a way of doing that, but I'm sort of sticking with but let's say that the normal interpretation of what we mean by Boolean mathematics, right? If a system is Boolean, you can ask a whole lot of experimental questions about the system, and you can conjoin all their answers, and you don't get a contradiction. That it's possible to know all the answers in sort of in sense one go. But
you demand all the answers combined according to the classical rules.
Yeah.
If A is answered yes and B is answered yes, then A or B should be answered.
That's right. So yeah. That's what Boolean means. And
so you include that under Boolean.
Yeah. Such things can be described by set theory, for example, and it's.
But what you can do is still describe the propositions by Boolean structure, but change the inference rules so that that second kind of deduction doesn't always work.
Right. That's right. Well, of course, in quantum logic, what you throw is the distribution rule, right? And yeah, you can do stuff like that.
But then you're changing the structure of the propositions themselves. That's different.
Well, isn't that just an inference rule? Isn't that just a change in the inference rule?
No, it's not, because the proposition A and B, well, maybe I don't want to
Check it. So. Okay, because there are a lot of ways of playing with this to try and get around this, right? There are many, many ways, and some really ingenious people have, tried different things. So I'm just trying to give you sort of the canonical center of the road picture here right now. What Petoskey showed very interestingly is that the Bell inequalities had first been discovered by George Boole back in the 1850s. Of course, he's not suggesting plagiarism on Bell's part at all. It's just that this is what jumps out at you when you think about this kind of thing. Boole had called these things conditions of possible experience. And you can, Petoskey explained them in terms of an urn model. Imagine you had this giant urn or vat full of, for example, balls with different colors and different properties. And you sort of take out a ball, look at it, notice properties, throw it back in the urn. And as long as you're not, when you take the balls out and look at them, as long as you're not disturbing the properties of the balls in the urn in doing that, you can start to write down consistency conditions. For example, let's see if I get this right. So the frequency with which you get, say, red wooden balls has to be less than or equal to the frequency with which you get red balls plus the frequency with which you get wooden balls, because there might be some red balls that aren't wooden, there might be some wooden balls that aren't red, and so forth. And that's a Bell inequality. That's all the Bell inequalities are, simple examples of that kind of thing. And Boole called them conditions of possible experience, kind of consistency conditions. So they're consistency conditions given that one examines a system without altering its properties. Okay, So non-Booleanity is simply the fact that, in some sense, quantum mechanics violates these consistency conditions. The way Goldmachlis put it in a paper a few years ago, he said that descriptions of quantum systems are incompletable because the presumption of completability entails a mathematical contradiction. But interestingly, Schrodinger said something like this way back in 1935. This is in the same paper that Schrodinger set forward his famous cat paradox. And he said, he first was talking specifically about a model of harmonic sort of an oscillator, but the point was taken generally. If I wish to ascribe to the model at each moment a definite state, or to all determining parts definite numerical values, then there is no supposition as to those numerical values to be imagined that would not conflict with some portion of quantum theoretical assertions. Now, I don't think Schrodinger had anything like a formal proof of this. It was just intuitively obvious to him from the way quantum mechanics behaved that in a sense, this is like an early statement of the Cauchy-Specker theorem. Not very precise, but of course, but that's the spirit of the thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
In I think this, you're referring to the Schrodinger cat paradox.
Yeah.
Essentially, he gives some essentially no-go theorems, which start from the same assumptions as von Neumann and so forth.
Yeah.
So I would read that as a statement of no hidden variables satisfied by Neumann's assumptions.
I honestly can't remember the part where he discussed it von Neumann specifically, but yeah, this is definitely, it's a, you could call it an old hidden variables result. We would now call it a sort of generalized quotient spectrum result. There isn't a consistent Boolean story about all the properties of that system. And again, I think to Schrodinger, which is obvious, he was a pretty good mathematician.
The thing is, I mean, it's not a qualitative assessment. I mean, although he doesn't mention von Neumann explicitly,
right.
When you look at his formal proofs,
yeah.
Quantitative proofs that are in the paper, he does have a Neumann theorem.
Okay.
And the assumptions that go into the proof are von Neumann's assumptions.
Okay, well, I should go obviously go back and look at that paper again. I certainly pulled this out of context. I took it as a general kind of ansatz or intuition or something about the whole. But you're right. He really did have at least a piece of a proof or maybe a first go at this kind of proof. And so really this goes back to 1935. But I'm going to have to go back and look at that paper again. You got me. Thinking on, and I'd like to see in a sense how general his results were in that paper. But the point is, in a sense, it was sort of obvious to Schrodinger. Schrodinger did a lot of, he actually coined the term entanglement. He wrote a couple of large papers on it also in 1935. But interestingly, the other thing that emerges is that Schrodinger actually made a mistake. He made, very rare for Schrodinger to make a physics mistake. Apparently made some mistakes in his personal life, which we won't get into. But very rare for him to make a physics mistake. But his mistake was he conjectured, and I don't think he had any proof for this, he conjectured that entanglement would fall off with distance. He thought it had to. He actually conjectured that it would diminish with distance. And of course, that's wrong. So, but he again, it really disturbed him. And he was just trying to save the last little bits of locality that he could desperately cling to by that, but I don't think. Sorry.
I think he was a good scientist in the sense that he said in his paper, "I am not fully convinced by the evidence, experimental mm-hmm. evidence to date, that entanglement will be found experimentally."
Okay.
So he was just pointing out that there's something
sure.
we haven't tested, which
right.
could come out another way.
Okay, sure, but he made, if you want to be brutal, he made a mistake in the sense that he made a call, he made a prediction that later proved to be wrong. Now, at the time, it may have been a reasonable call for him to make, and I think it was. He did end up being wrong about it. He said if entanglement diminishes the distance, it doesn't, as far as we know.
Well, it does in the vacuum. It depends exactly what the concept he had in mind.
Well,
it arranged to keep it. Drawing at a distance. I mean, if you just take sort of generic quantum state, like the vacuum, then it certainly falls off.
We may be niggling at this point,
yeah,
but my own memory is that he said one possible way out of the mysteries that I point out here is that.
That it falls off.
That
right.
it falls off.
Yes. Yeah, it was just sort of.
And if you want to be brutal about him making a mistake, you can point to the 15 or 20 papers he wrote on unified field theories. Now, there's
yeah.
some mistakes.
Probably contains some very pretty mathematics. Yeah. Okay, so even, look, if Schroeder can be wrong, I can be wrong, okay? But it's all, I'm allowed. But the point is, what you had at this time was people realizing there's something funny going on and being generally very uncomfortable with it. In Einstein's case, kind of going into denial a little bit about it. Schrodinger at least attempted to come to grips with it, and perhaps not 100% successfully, but he did take it on in a way that even Einstein didn't. Okay, so here's a sort of a picturesque way of thinking about it. Fitting quantum mechanical predictions to a Boolean substrate is like trying to smooth out a carpet cut from the surface of a sphere onto a flat floor. Right? There will be a lump. And you can move it around, and you can even stuff it under the furniture for a while, but you can't make the lump go away. And a lot of the time, what people have been doing, in a sense, in their various interpretations of quantum mechanics is moving that lump around to different spots. You can, if you don't like it here, you can move it over there, but pretty hard to make it go away. So this is more of a small point here, and I don't want to belabor this, but it's not entirely accurate, therefore, to call
the no-go theorems, no hidden variables theorems. More accurately, there are no Boolean variables theorems. And even more precisely, you might call them not enough Boolean variables theorems, because non-Boolean systems can have Boolean subspaces. Right? So in a sense, you call them, but it doesn't sound quite as picturesque when you call them not enough Boolean variable theorems. So we've really lost everybody. So the Bell quotient Specker theorem, in very crude and rough summary, quantum mechanics in general disagrees with presumption, but all experimentally answerable questions have yes-no answers before we ask them, where before does not mean with respect to the time coordinate, but with respect to the invariant sequence of preparation and measurement operations taken on the system. Okay. So what would be the, I want to look just a little bit at the logical structure of no-go theorems. And I'm going to run out of time here, but okay, there's a couple of things I can, you lied. So general logical, sorry. Okay, I'm good for something like that. So we arrive at a paradox if we assume that a quantum system has a Boolean property structure. General structure, Bell's argument is actually what we philosophers call a modus tollens. P implies Q, not Q, therefore not P. So there are many papers, and several papers in the literature called For Whom Bell's Theorem Tolls. It's actually a double pun. Okay, so I love puns. So no-go theorems are negative results. This is a more important point. They're negative results. They show you what doesn't work, but they do not directly show you what to replace it with. Very important point. And so there are a fair number of people, David Merman said something like this, for example, there are a fair number of people who essentially say, well, the correlations are there because, this is actually a direct quote from Merman, he says, well, the correlations are there because that's what the calculation gives you. End of story. Let's go for a lunch. Let's go for a beer, right? Okay. Oh, now this, I'll skip this part because it's very speculative and we don't have got time. Okay. So how could you characterize a region of the notion of a closed future precisely? Here's my proposal. Well, it's not very precise, but it's at least a proposal. The region of space-time is ontologically closed only if it has a Boolean property structure. There's a reason why I said only if and not if and only if, but let's skip that for now. A region of space-time is ontologically closed only if it has a Boolean property structure. So why? First of all, this captures the intuitive notion, I think, suggested by Weil, for example, that it's all there. It's all a given. Because that's what something that's Boolean is. It's like Petovsky's urn. It's there in front of you. It's all there. Mathematically, the block universe interpretation implies that the region inside the forward cone of any event is a continuous manifold of real numbers, differentiable, and it has to be differentiable to at least order 2 in order to support Maxwell's equations. And such structures are Boolean, right? The question is, if you want to attack the block universe theory, the block universe theory certainly implies that space-time has a Boolean structure. Because this classical relativistic spacetime has a Boolean structure, because, well, it just does. It describes spacetime as a sort of real numbered manifold, four-dimensional hyperbolic manifold, and it's got to be differentiable to at least order 2, because you've got to have Maxwell's equations, which are second order. So, and that's a structure like that is a Boolean structure.
Because it's built out of real numbers and.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
I mean, the main point is
a real valued Boolean, a real valued vector space might be Boolean, but maybe not a complex one. I'm just not sure about that. Good question. I don't know.
It just seems that this is a big leap.
Oh, sure. That's what I do.
In the sense that I can take a quantum mechanical state space, and certainly, let's say it's a manifold of real numbers.
Yeah, because you can see where I'm going with this, right?
In fact, it's a linear vector space.
Yeah.
But somehow, ultimately, it gets associated with a non-Boolean structure via how it's used.
Mm-hmm. I just have to term the
propositions of quantum mechanics in terms of that vector space.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I just want to have to think about it. I hadn't thought about it that way. I'm talking about really good physical space here, not. Quantum, not something like Hilbert space or Fock space or anything, but physical space we have to assume that it's Boolean, or it seems to me that the part of the problem is nobody's ever thought about this. So I'm taking my first stab and saying, okay, if you believe in something like a block inverse theory or something in that general neighborhood, how are you going to characterize that mathematically? Well, first candidate, let's call this a zeroth order candidate, is something with a Boolean structure. And maybe we can fine tune that suggestion. So,
now, one way of thinking about this, I'm going to be really short on time here, is Wheeler's delayed choice experiment. I've been reading about this even since I wrote these slides and realizing that I understand it even less badly than I thought I, or even more badly than I thought I did. Wheeler proposed a famous thought experiment with an interferometer, which would extend several billion light years with the light from a distant quasar bent around a gravitational lens. A measurement choice in an earthly lab seems to determine which path some photons took, even though they were emitted billions of years ago. Now, again, the interpretation of this there's very recent verifications of similar setups, but the interpretation is exceedingly controversial. But I'm kind of going with what Wheeler's version of this at the moment. I think this can be set up as equivalent to some kind of Bell quotient Specker experiment. But the important point is, I should really pose this as a question. Could we say that well-verified beam splitter experiments like this show that the past is to some degree non-Boolean? Now, we're talking about the open future, but saying maybe the past is to some degree non-Boolean as well. I find that to be a very disturbing concept, and it's actually taken me some years to sort of wrap my mind around the ability to say, okay, maybe, you know. Let's just hold that thought. But here's just a side issue. Could we say President Kennedy? Okay, if we can change the past by a measurement choice in the lab today, can we go back and deflect a bullet and save a president? All right, and then it leads you to all the familiar paradoxes of time travel. I say no. We could not have deflected a bullet and save a certain president because we know we did not. It didn't happen. The only events which we can change in the past, if Wheeler is right, okay, subscript that with if Wheeler is right, the only events we can change in the past are among those we do not presently know about now. So it's very analogous. In fact, it really is just a double slit experiment in which knowing which slit the particle goes through wipes out the interference and thereby wipes out the non-Boolean effect. So double slit experiment, if you know which slit the particle went through, you lose the interference pattern. Okay, so similarly, if we know about a certain event, a certain series of events that might have occurred in the past, they don't interfere anymore. And so there's no question of this funny kind of Wheelerian effect occurring here. But here's the really crazy thing I'm coming up with, and I just don't have the technical background just to see how to make this work. So I'm throwing this out to the general audience here to see if this might work. And really, the next slide is in almost the core of my talk, although it's the least well-defined part of my talk. Could there be, if we have delayed choice experiments, could there be something that we could call an advanced choice experiment, right, along something like the following lines? And this is really, really crazy, all right, but the heck, that's what I'm here for. There is good reason to take the idea of advanced or time reverse influences seriously. And of course, that goes all the way back to the Wheeler-Feynman emitter theory of the 1940s, and I know people have been working on this very recently as well, the idea of influences coming back from the future. All right? If that means anything at all, and I you don't have to know exactly how it would work to see the point I'm going to make here. could we do this? Could we define some sort of interferometer in which correlations in the here and now are a function of interference between retarded and advanced influences? Could you do that? I think some people have come close to doing that, but that's the general idea. I conjecture that one would almost certainly find that the correlations would violate the assumption that the emitters of the advanced potentials in the future had a Boolean property structure. And something like this, I think, ought to be doable. There's some papers by J.D. Franson in the early 90s in which I think he almost does this, but I can't fully understand his papers. But that's the general idea. can you do a sort of an advanced choice experiment? That is, we do a choice now that with something like an interferometer, with world lines going into the past and the future, in which there's the correlations in our apparatus in our lab today are determined by interference between retarded and advanced potentials. And if the future state would had a Boolean property structure, that interference wouldn't exist. That's the general kind of idea I'm trying to get at here. This is at least gives you a handle in principle on how quantum mechanics might maybe be able to address this deep metaphysical question. Should I rant on, or did somebody want to ask a question about that? I can sort of cut to the quick in a couple more minutes, but just think about that. It's perhaps a really, really crazy idea, but okay, so quantum definition of time, very, very quickly here. In some sense, it's this non-Booleanity or quantum uncertainty in space-time should have a measure similar to other measures of quantum mechanical uncertainty. So the degree of openness of a region of space-time should be a quantitative matter, right? However, to compute this, call it the ontological gappiness, you would require a theory of quantum gravity that tells you how to count the states of space. And I don't think, obviously, a lot of people are working on that. I don't think we quite have that yet. A reasonable guess might be that the future has a much greater measure of uncertainty, or like non-Booleanity, than the past. So proposal time is the direction in which the measure of non-Booleanity varies. Space is the direction in which it stays the same. Okay, I'm going to run. Oh, darn. Yeah. Okay, let's skip the standard argument. We can argue about that later. There's a whole bunch of stuff there. But just to wrap it up, would this despatialize time? I'm not sure. But it certainly makes time a lot less like a spatial coordinate in the following sense. Space is characterized by joint or coexistence, or perhaps concurrence. Concurrence is definable not in terms of time coordinate, but in terms of dynamical properties of matter. And in a couple of my other papers, I've tried to work out different ways that that could be done in terms of phase and action, for example. They're obviously pretty tentative still at this point. The Bell quotient theorems show that not all possibles can be compossible. To use Leibniz's term, compossibility just means things that can be possible, in a sense, together without contradiction. Space, let us say, is constructed out of states that are compossible, defined as an ordering of states that cannot coexist or become possible. And in some cases, it may be possible to define a time or time-like parameter that labels a succession of possible spaces, but that certainly wouldn't be any absolute time that Newton would have recognized as such. So this is my last slide. The classical picture, therefore, is one of maximal compossibility. Roughly, what is not compulsory is forbidden in the classical picture. Quantum view, there is less restriction on what is possible in general, but not everything that is possible is compossible. And it seems to me that makes for a more interesting universe. Okay, well, we had to skip a whole bunch of stuff there. But I didn't get into the discussion of simultaneity, which is pretty critical at a certain point in the argument. But anyway, giving you enough, I hope, to ruin your evening. So thank you. You want to just do a few questions then, or?
A couple of questions. Jim Brown should go first. He's the graduate advisor.
And he's sitting there going, oh my God, why did I accept Ken as a student?
My pen ran out of ink, and so I, the little notes I was going to write down, I think I've forgotten them for some of them. But a few slides back, you had an argument that made the future region, the future time code, continuous. And I didn't see why on earth that should follow at all.
Well, in classical relativity, it's a continuous.
Okay, it is, but yeah. Why does this follow from the Boolean nature?
No, it's the other way around. Because Booleanity follows from the fact that it's a continuous manifold. Continuous manifolds are better.
Why should that hold also? Why would continuity imply Boolianity or vice versa?
I'm not a good enough mathematician to give you an accurate answer to that question. I know that it's that it's right. Yeah, it's called Stone Representation Theorem, and I honestly can't give you a, show you how it works. But classical continuous manifolds, differentiable manifolds, are Boolean structures. That's quite well established mathematically. I rely on the authority of others to state that.
You might just say, in what sense are they?
Sorry, in what sense what?
In what sense are they Boolean structures? What do you mean by that? Does it have a meaning? Does it have a precise meaning?
Yeah, it does. And again, I don't know the math well enough to explicate that properly. It's one of the things that I certainly want to study a bit better. But what does it mean exactly? Well, it certainly means, among other things, that particles can have exact trajectories, that you know where everything is, and we just have a classical picture. Things are arrayed in space-time in a very definite way, maybe in a very complicated way, but still are things arrayed in space-time in a definite way, and in principle you can know where they are, and they're all given by the laws of physics expressed in four-dimensional form. It's all there. It's that kind of idea that it's all there. It's the kind of thing that Weil was talking about. That's the cash value of it, for at least philosophically. Yeah.
I also, because of the same way Chris is, but let me ask, but I also was very curious to know what your counter argument is, the standard argument or whatever, which you skipped over.
Okay.
Is it possible to summarize it in a line or something?
Well, okay. Yeah, it goes back to that second premise, which I emphasize in the standard argument. The second premise says the only physically significant simultaneity relation is in terms of time coordinate. And my view, and I've been working on this for a long time, and Jim was one of my early victims on this, was the idea that there may be other notions of simultaneity that are physically relevant. And one way, it is not the only way to approach it, but one way to approach it that I make reference to, well, okay, I'll just go back a little bit to the, maybe I can find the right slide here, I'm suggesting we need a more general conception of simultaneity, which simultaneities in general would be some sort of equivalence relation on events. All right, now even that is a controversial point. For example, Grunbaum had a notion of simultaneity that wasn't an equivalence relation, but I don't buy that. I think a simultaneity relation has to be an equivalence relation. And then in Latin, the word has two interesting meanings. It means at the same time, of course, but it has this other meaning, in joint process. And only in a Newtonian universe with absolute time would it make sense to equate those two conceptions. So we automatically assume that if things were somehow, in some sense, in joint process, that can only mean they're at the same time. And then, of course, add into that Einstein's observation about the relativity of simultaneity in terms of the time coordinate, and you get that there's no invariant way of talking about things being in joint process unless they're very, very close to each other. Right? So one could say the fact that we still insist that physical changes, such as state reduction, have to be linked to the time coordinate just shows how hard it is to get away from the Newtonian picture. So one way of arguing this is, in a sense, we're still hung up on the Newtonian picture. I mean, you probably know that this problem of finding a covariant description of state reduction or wave function collapse, and every paper on this turns on the assumption, well, if you know any way of describing wave function collapse in space-time would have to be along hyperplanes of simultaneity, and then, of course, they're only frame-dependent, so therefore, observers can't agree on when the wave function collapses, and many, many people have published some version of that argument, right? And to me, that's just I say, well, why do you assume that state reduction would have to be tied to hyperplanes of time coordinate? I just don't see that at all. There's other ways of thinking about it, for example, in terms of phase and that are covariant. And so, I mean, this is a work in progress. I've published a bit on this, but I'm still working on it. I'm trying to get other people interested in this kind of idea that there are other ways to think about simultaneity. And what Einstein taught us, of course, it's relevant, it's important, but it's not the only relevant kind of simultaneity. If there's any kind of non-locality, if non-locality is, or non-separability, or whatever you want to call it, is in any sense physically real, And we can debate for a long time of what possible senses there might be about that, but is it in any sense physically real? Then you need a broader conception of simultaneity. And rather than saying, oh, well, Einstein would just rule that out, that's to put the cart before the horse. I'm saying, look, we need a broader conception of simultaneity. And the notion in a relativistic space-time, the notion that there could be things to be in some sense, say, space-like separated events can be in some sense joined or part of one larger process is okay as long as you realize that they don't have to be at the same time. Right? Their relationship could be described possibly by proper quantities, but they don't have to be described in terms of a frame-dependent coordinates, such as time. That's the general idea I'm getting at.
It's hard for me to imagine what you have in mind if you talk about an equivalence class, then it has to produce something. An equivalence class, it seems to me, has to produce something like a space-like hypersurface. It doesn't have to be flat.
Yeah, that's right. Very good.
Hypersurface, but you're still assuming that there would be some notion of presence, which would be possibly a curvy thing. But
that's right, yeah.
But that would still be in conflict with general relativity.
I don't see
with the spirit of general relativity.
Well, okay.
Tells
here we go.
Us that there's no distinguished slicing.
Is it in conflict? Is it in conflict with what general relativity says, or what is the scientific content of something being in conflict with the spirit of relativity?
It means that you're giving an extra structure that's not in the theory itself. That you're,
well,
you're saying that this particular hypersurface constitutes a present, but there's nothing in the structure of the theory as it's normally presented or as we use
right.
it that allows you to select.
Well, it might be what the theory does.
Particular way.
Yeah, I've been having this argument for. The response is the theory allows for such structures.
So does special relativity.
Sure. The first thing I did in this was in context
right,
of special relativity.
Flat.
Yeah. Well, they don't have to be, as you quite correctly said, they don't have to be flat. Now, you're doing very well. I've had a lot of very smart people who couldn't quite get to that. You're talking about hyperplanes, are you? Not necessarily. They might be surfaces with funny topology and a lot of people can't even get to that point. But yeah, what I'm suggesting is that, for example, you can set up a thought experiment in which space-like separate particles under certain initial conditions would be in some sense considered to be linked would be at the same fit as the same action. So you can use action as a criterion.
What's action?
Actions, distance or energy times time.
I don't know what that means as a coordinate.
Well, it's not a coordinate. No, it's a dynamic property. So the point is these hypersurfaces of simultaneity would not be defined purely in terms of metrical properties. They're defined partially by dynamical properties as well.
I mean, you could give this, well, maybe, at least I wanted to get to the idea of what. So you're not trying to do away with the need for a simultaneous presence. You're just trying to loosen the notion.
I'm trying to loosen the notion.
Simultaneity might be.
I'm trying to loosen the notion in a way that's hopefully consistent with what we know about physics, right?
I mean, you can certainly make up. I mean, the physicist Fock suggested ways, and many people have since pointed out that in general relativity there are ways of introducing coordinates based on the curvature tensor or based on other deviations that it has from being in Brussels space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, but they all appear artificial. None of them stands out as having a claim to being so special that you should identify some ontological property.
Well,
and then they just don't play a role in the theory, even if you introduce
it. Well, it depends what you mean by playing a role in the theory. Depends what you mean by playing a role in the theory. See,
I
mean,
should make this your final response. And you.
Okay. And you're coming out.
You're cut off.
What's this?
See, in Newtonian theory.
An opportunity to say it. Let's thank the speaker again. Go on.
Okay. In Newtonian theory, absolute time plays a special role. All of the physical quantities vary with respect to absolute time. In the theory that takes Minkowski space as a background, all other quantities vary with respect to space-time coordinates, a sort of more generalization of the Newtonian picture, right? in general relativity, there are no privileged coordinates, right? I'm trying to argue with something that's in the spirit of general relativity, and there are no privileged coordinates. However, there's all kinds of things you can take as de facto coordinates for practical purposes and so forth. And they're all history dependent. There are things that are allowed by the laws of physics. For example, we could take this desktop here as a frame of reference if we wanted to, right? But why is this desktop the way it is? Well, it's just because of the history of the universe. There's nothing law-like about why this desktop is the way it is. But you could take it as a reference point if you want, right? Similarly, I'm suggesting there are these sort of simultaneity classes of events. Now, their exact shape and topology and so forth is, again, a function of cosmological history, or physical history in a sense. There's nothing law-like about why they exactly are the way they are. But you're allowed to take them as a reference point. But they're not privileged in the sense that absolute time is privileged in Newtonian theory. They're just something that, so it's a question of not of what's, it's sort of like a law-like versus contingent distinction, to use philosopher's language again. Einstein was right. There is no really law-like simultaneity relation. In the sense that there isn't a Newtonian theory, but there are, my view is that there are all kinds of possibilities for contingent simultaneity structures, depending on what kind of junk is floating around in space-time at the time. It depends on the history of the particles and fields involved. And when you've got something like that, then you have a tool which you can at least discuss some notion of an open future, closed past, this kind of thing. So that was the general idea I'm trying to get at.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy the talk.
Okay. Thanks.